Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Coffee Clatch. This is Marianne Russo. I'd like to acknowledge my co-moderators, Elise, Pierrette, Chuck, and Jane. They're not with us on the radio tonight, but they are on the tweet chat where people can go on and interact. And we will be taking calls at the end of the session if you'd like to speak with Susan Inman. My guest tonight, Susan Inman, has written the book, After Her Brain Broke, Helping My Daughter Recover Her Sanity, which is just an incredible story. You know, as I was reading it, I was saying to myself, is this a novel or did this really happen? Because this is a real eye-opener for people who are not dealing with a family member with mental illness. And it is a book that anyone, any parent especially, of a child with a mental illness can definitely relate to. I'm just going to read a little something from the introduction, which was written by the Mental Health Commission of Canada. While critical of the guidance and help professionals should, but often don't provide to families, Susan is even harsher with herself and often wonders if she had done everything she could for her daughter. I mean, I think this everyone can share who's in our audience because we're all dealing with children with special needs. So let me introduce Susan Inman. How are you tonight?
I'm very well, and I'm really happy to have a chance to talk about the issues in this book.
Well, you know, it's so important because, you know, I think a lot of people have misconceptions about mental illness. I know there are a lot of misconceptions about schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorder. So, you know, I'm glad to have you on that you can really go through all of this with us because it's very important for people to understand what the families go through.
It's very important for everybody to remember that these really are common disorders. 1 in 100 people have bipolar disorder, and 1 in 100 have schizophrenia. We are not talking about rare disorders, so there are many families out there coping with the kinds of chaotic situations that can develop.
Absolutely, and you know, these disorders oftentimes start in early childhood. Some start in their teens, and you know, this is something that a lot of families suffer with in silence, and it's just so unnecessary. And, you know, we often speak of how this is a lifelong journey. I mean, when you have a child with a mental illness or a special needs or autism, I mean, this is lifelong. And although, you know, we may be able to manage the disorders, you know, this is our life path. And, you know, I know that Molly, your daughter, has had a relapse this year, and, you know, I'm glad to hear she's doing better. You know, it's a struggle. And, you know, in reading the book, I mean, we might as well just go into it. I mean, the book starts with, you know, what seems like a very sudden onset at age 15, I think. Now, she was already, Molly was already on Paxil when you first noticed this very odd behavior that she was having. Can you just explain to us why she was on Paxil initially and what changes you saw after she was raised on the Paxil?
Right. Molly had had a pretty happy younger childhood. She wasn't necessarily somebody who was real comfortable with peers, but really happy with the various activities that she liked, happy at home, but never totally comfortable at school, but a quite good student. She began to be bullied in late elementary school, and we were quite concerned. And at that point, we made our first mistake when you were talking about parents thinking about bad decisions. I think that the particular decision we made at that point was probably one of the worst that we could have made, which is, we took her to a private therapist. My husband teaches in the local university, University of British Columbia. He asked various colleagues for any kind of referrals, and we ended up with someone I call Veronica. And, you know, we were so naive at that point that we never even thought to ask, you know, does this person have any training on serious mental illness? Because the possibility of this never entered our mind. I went to graduate school.
So you thought it was all situational at that point.
Exactly. In the days that I went to grad school at UCLA, it was a belief system that really mental illnesses are about nurture, not nature. They stem from, you know, really significant mistreatment as children. It's certainly a parenting issue. And I felt very safe, and I think other parents can relate to this. As long as we were being really good parents and things were going well, these were not disorders that we would ever have to think about. Unfortunately, that really isn't the nature of these neurobiological disorders. Good parenting is not something that can prevent a child from developing one of these. When we took Molly to this therapist, we really wanted her to develop some assertiveness skills. We thought this would help her hold her own on the playground. But this therapist had a different agenda, and we eventually found out...
Well, how old was this therapist? I have to say, I was so taken back. And, you know, I'm glad that you said that you were very naive when you started all of this, because, you know, you thought you were going in for, a situational type therapy. But, her type of therapy reminds me of, you know, back in the days in the 50s when, parents, mothers of children with autism were labeled the refrigerator moms. I mean, it's just barbaric.
And, you know, unfortunately, and this is something that's so important for parents to realize, the ongoing training of a lot of mental health professionals has not improved. They, like this particular therapist who didn't realize she was seeing early stages of a psychotic disorder, dealt completely inappropriately with our daughter. She made her believe that there was some kind of family secret that would explain her growing distress, and if they could just find that, then Molly would be okay. And this created unnecessary friction in our relationship with Molly, which actually had been quite smooth.
We'll progress to that. I mean, because you didn't find out about that until, later on, because, your daughter came home one day from a friend's house, and she, like I said initially, I mean, it just seems from what you wrote that, this was a pretty mild-mannered child. She was on Paxil. I don't know why she was put on the Paxil, which is why I was asking you, because
right.
Were there
and
any
so
earlier
I'm happy
sign?
To explain that. The situation at school began to deteriorate, and it was as if Molly was becoming less intelligent in some way. It just became school became harder for her. I mean, we understand now that we were seeing a prodrome of schizophrenia, which affects cognition. We didn't understand that at this point, and certainly the people we took her to for psychoed testing didn't understand this. And suddenly, our daughter, who had read adult books at grade 4, was diagnosed as having serious learning disabilities, and we were treated by these educational psychologists as some people who must be in denial. You know, I'm a teacher. I mean, I would have easily accepted the reality of having a child with learning disabilities. And so
she was initially put on the Paxil for depression because of
exactly.
what they thought was a bullying situation. And then once she was on the Paxil, and this is age 15,
right.
So once she, then her behaviors started to become very startling. I mean, they were very, it was a sudden onset, and she seemed to have a very different, behaviors, very odd behaviors, and she came
absolutely.
Home. And,
absolutely.
And
what we noticed was, just these sudden bursts into anger. And, I'm a teacher, and as I said, my husband is a professor, in fact, in a faculty of education. And we were very ready to think, well, this is great, Molly's really asserting herself, and anger is an important part of adolescence. But this, and so we tried to normalize it. That was our response
right.
to it, until it really became clear that she was becoming psychotic. And that led to her first hospitalization at age 15, for a manic break, and eventually we understood that, in fact, the Paxil had flipped her into mania, and that people need
that's what I was trying to get you to. I mean, for my daughter, it was Zoloft.
Right.
So it's not the Paxil, per se, so I don't
want
anyone who has a child on Paxil thinking, oh, my God, every kid is different. And really, I mean, what it comes down to is what I say all the time, which is, start low and go slow. And if you see any behaviors coming back, if you see a worsening of behaviors, I mean, really, pull back on the medication. Don't raise the medication.
These
SSRIs have a tendency to, like you said, to flip or to, turn on the switch for other types of, bipolar and other types
right.
of disorders.
Right, and certainly there's a lot of research now that if there is any kind of genetic predisposition to bipolar disorder, that a depressed teenager should not be put on an SSRI without some kind of mood stabilizer introduced first, because this response is so common.
And, you know, so at this point, I mean, obviously she was a danger to herself, and she and her behavior was so difficult. And, you know, one thing I want to say, that somebody's going to be reading your book, and, you know, I could, you know, I'm reading it and I'm saying, oh, only another parent could understand this. But when she came home and she was saying, you know, and you went to sit down when you wanted to talk to her about, you know, her behavior, and she was saying, you know, I didn't tell you you could sit. And, you know, so you stood up. And I said, you know, anybody who doesn't understand this is going to say, you know, what's wrong with these parents? But any parent who has a child knows that dark look, you know.
Right.
And, you know, any parent dealing with this knows that being confrontational with an irrational child will just serve no purpose. So,
absolutely.
You know,
you're
the way
right.
you handled it, you know, was really the best way to handle it.
Yeah.
You know, as then she was in the hospital, I mean, and that must have been shocking, because you found out that, you know, you used the name Veronica, the treating therapist, actually had told the doctors at the hospital that you were a dysfunctional family.
Yes, I was very surprised.
So, but you
I
know
had
what
never
I
realized we were a dysfunctional family. We actually
who knew?
Be a pretty happy family.
I guess we're all dysfunctional. We have children with, you know, with special needs. It must be our fault.
That's right.
But, how long was she seeing Veronica, and why did you not have any sessions with her?
She saw Veronica for a couple of years before this psychotic break, and we would ask Veronica, what do you want to meet with us too? And Veronica would say, well, no, Molly is really just not ready, but I'm really tracking down slowly the bullying episode. So she kept this whole other agenda that she was pursuing with Molly around the family secret, and introducing to Molly the notion that, you know, your family, this was a refrain I speak of in the book. Once she had this break, to explain it to herself, Molly kept saying what the therapist had said, you know, you have a family that's full of secrets and lies, and, you know, this has really hurt you. And this was unbelievable to us. And so we had asked,
so for the years
and we didn't realize anything
Veronica
was going wrong. Sorry?
So for the years that Molly was seeing Veronica, for the first couple of
right.
years, you'd never had any sessions with Molly, just your husband and yourself? I mean, I'm sorry,
no.
Your husband and yourself with Veronica? Yeah, I mean,
no.
That just seems so odd to me. I mean, maybe that's how it's done. You're in Canada. I forgot to
mm-hmm.
mention that. You know, that just seems so odd to me. And
We would
you know,
either,
I mean, that was just the tip of the iceberg.
We would take Molly to the sessions and say hello and talk, chat in a friendly way at the end. And a couple
right.
of times we made phone calls just to check in about this issue. Do you want to see us, or how is it going? It seems to be taking a long time. Molly still, you know, seems quite troubled about going to school, which is why, especially once these previously non-existent learning disabilities emerged, and she became quite depressed, and that's why we put her on the Paxil. And, of course, as we were saying, that's what flipped her into mania, and really since then, 10 years now, she has been dealing with a serious schizoaffective disorder, a psychotic disorder.
You know, and it's like it's, you go to the doctors, you get the prescription, you know, you and I, we've both made a mistake. I mean, that's part of why I do what I'm doing, is because, you know, if we can share with other parents the mistakes that we've made and keep them from making the mistakes that we've made and, you know, save their children.
Absolutely.
I mean,
and I think
what we're here for.
We want to take away from this conversation that's happening right now is the message to parents who are dealing with serious mental illnesses. Do not assume that social workers, counseling psychologists, all kinds of people who are represented as mental health professionals will have ever had any training or up-to-date training on serious mental illnesses. Psychiatry actually has improved. I mean, families, as you were mentioning earlier, really struggled through the 20th century to get psychiatry back to its medical roots in looking at serious mental illnesses. And it took a long time. But by the 1990s, in the era of the brain, that was all happening. I mean, psychiatrists are not generally, or younger ones are not the problem now. But these other programs, we really need to be lobbying all of the organizations that accredit any program that gives somebody a credential to go out and be a mental health professional. They need to be sure that they are mandating that curriculum on serious mental illness must be included, because Otherwise, these are the situations that arise. And certainly in Canada, and actually I know from just being at a NAMI conference in the States, people are talking a lot about early intervention programs and the importance, which they are very important in the earliest stages of the appearance of something, of a psychotic disorder, getting somebody into treatment. But that depends upon all of these other allied mental health professionals understanding this and making the referral to what could be excellent early intervention programs. But somebody needs to get the family on the right path.
Absolutely. And, you know, many parents walk into, a psychiatrist's office when they get to that point, that they know that the child has a mental illness and, needs some type of medication to, balance them. And, they walk out with the prescription and they walk into the pharmacy and, they don't do their homework. I didn't do my homework the first time. I do my homework now.
Well,
I think that's important, that the parents need to do your own homework.
But one of the things that we have to say in defense of parents, because it's such a new situation, is that, if I have a strep throat and I go in and I get a prescription, I don't go and do a lot of research about strep throats. I just believe that, my physician did a slide and there was some lab work and this is going to be the antibiotic that will address that. I don't feel like it's incumbent upon me to know all of the details physiologically. And you are absolutely wise in advising parents that it's a different situation with these illnesses, and parents can be their child's best advocate by finding out as much as they can about whatever disorder.
That is our motto. I don't know if you know that. That's our motto on the show.
Oh, okay.
Yes, it is. And the thing is, becoming an informed and educated parent is key, and like I said, I learned this the hard way. And if you feel something is not right, don't do it. This is no time to be intimidated or embarrassed. And, over the course of this illness and over the course of the time that you have a child under 21 years old, there are going to be many different doctors that you see for different consults, and you're going to be putting, assembling teams. And, you have to find the right fit. And, these doctors, they're brilliant and, they have these drugs. But what you have to understand is that you know your child.
Right.
And what works for one child does not work for another child. And you can say, I've tried an anticonvulsant and, we've had this type of a response and it was, a negative response. I'd rather try a different group. You have to be part of that team.
Yes.
That advocates for your child, even when it comes to, the medications. And, Molly, your daughter, I call it the medication roller coaster.
Yes. And let's get there. I just want to say one more thing about the important points that you're raising about family education. In order to be the most effective member of a team, as you're saying, we need to learn so much. And I was so shocked when my daughter was in Children's Hospital in Vancouver, and she initially had a diagnosis of a bipolar disorder, and I kept going to all the nurses to find out, if this is such a common disorder, there must be some groups out in Vancouver, and can you put me in touch? Are there any phone numbers? Nobody knew of any. In fact, they were out there, and things, I have to say, in these 10 years have improved tremendously for families, and the whole system functions better around helping families find their way to family education. And at that point, what was being offered, and it took me a couple of years to locate it, was a spectacular American program that Americans have access to. And some Canadians are fortunate, which is called Family to Family, and it's put together by the National Alliance on Mental Illness, which is the largest advocacy group in the world. And I talk a lot about NAMI in the book because it has meant so much to me in giving me a foundation for understanding all kinds of experiences and being able to make better choices.
They are just incredible. Incredible. We've had them on the show twice. And, what they do and the support that they give, it's just incredible. It really is.
Yes.
I will never hear the name Veronica again and not feel a pang in my heart.
Yes, I understand.
Oh boy, I give you credit. I don't know how you do it. Just to finish up with Veronica, who was the therapist treating Molly.
Right.
you know, she had not only told the hospital that, you know, Molly's problems were coming from a dysfunctional family, which couldn't have been further from the truth, but also she would say things to Molly. You know, she would say psychiatrists like to play mind games. You know,
yes.
It's just something that
yes.
they do, and she needed to be careful. And
in terms of your earlier
point, was this woman
of-
ever charged with malpractice? Is she still practicing?
That's a very good question, and certainly at the time, it vaguely occurred to me, I need to follow this up, I need to, you know, do something about this, but it was so overwhelming for the first few years when Molly had a profound psychotic episode. She eventually was profoundly psychotic for 2 years. So pursuing anything beyond the daily care of Molly
absolutely
would have been beside the question. I think that should happen, but what I did instead was to write this book and to alert other families and to be involved in many different kinds of educational pursuits that bring this issue of the poor training of many therapists to light. And I can tell you a good story that's come out of this. You know, I complain actively and loudly in the book about the University of British Columbia's counseling psychology program that still gives masters in counseling psych and neither offers nor requires a course on serious mental illness. After the book came out last spring, there was a lot of hubbub, apparently. Somebody included me in some emails of people seeing this program's difficulties brought to light. And I have to give them total credit. They solved that by inviting me in to do a colloquium for the staff about serious mental illnesses and the need for this kind of training to be in the program. And I understand that it takes programs a while to change and people have tenure and, you know, it's complicated. But I can tell you that that program very much wants to change. They understand what this problem is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know if I've just been very fortunate or, you know, if this was a very isolated incident, but I mean, parents, I mean, if something's not going well, if any of your child's treating physicians are not sharing information with you, that is a huge red flag.
You're right.
And, you know, parents just need to, this is no time to be embarrassed. When,
right.
You know, you're dealing with a child with a mental illness who is easy prey, I mean, this is no time to be intimidated or embarrassed. So, you know, I really admire you for coming forward with this story because I'm sure there are many, many other families that are going through this and are not even aware of it.
I have to tell you, Marianne,
this
happened to our family, you know, I teach English. I read all the time, and also I had done graduate work in this field at UCLA, I was just sure that I would be able to locate some other family stories and get my bearings because I really felt profoundly disoriented because my whole paradigm about how mental illness develops was completely blown apart. I just lost the train of thought.
That's okay. You know, what you were saying actually was going to bring me to, you know, the next part of what I wanted to speak about, which was, you know, your thoughts on how mental illness develops. And, you know, it just was, when I was reading the book, I kept saying to myself, wow, did she have a prenatal virus? You know, what season was this child born? You know, there are so many factors in schizophrenia.
You're absolutely right. And
you know,
we actually know so much now about this. It's definitely not entirely genetic, although it's hugely genetic. But there are environmental factors. Unfortunately, that is leading some people again to try to get back to there must have been abusive parenting. But environmental factors means all kinds of things, exactly what you're saying. There's a lot of research literature now. If people go to the National Institute of Mental Health website, they can find endless studies on these kinds of issues because really now research is being done. And one of the hugest pieces of advice I would give anybody in talking to the siblings of people with serious mental illness or friends or other relatives is that, you know, we can't prevent schizophrenia and bipolar disorder at this point. But there's some things that we can do that could make it less likely. And one of the most important is exactly what you were getting at. People need to have flu shots. Women need to understand if they're contemplating getting pregnant, they need to have a flu shot. I just, this week I got an email notice of a new research study about the connection between flu during pregnancy and schizophrenia. I mean, this is...
And not just schizophrenia, mental illness in general.
Uh-huh, yes.
Schizophrenia primarily.
Right.
But mental illness in general. Prenatally, in the, I have to look it up now. I actually wrote a paper on this and I can't remember
it.
I believe it's in the second trimester.
Yes.
Is very predominant with children with different mental illnesses, the seasons of birth, I mean, the winter seasons, and that correlates with the flus and that too. But, you know, there's also genetics. I mean, there's a higher link, I believe, to the maternal family with schizophrenia.
Okay, I don't know about that. Mm-hmm. That can be there, and I just may not have seen it. The age of sperm is a factor. Certainly, any complication during the delivery is a factor.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing we really do need to alert families to, and this was not an issue for Molly just because of how she was in the world and her youth, and she had no connection to street drugs. But marijuana isn't the benign drug that many parents
might think
that it is because, you know, when they were in college, they smoked a marijuana joint and it was not a big deal. It really is a big deal. There's research going on worldwide now that it absolutely, it can, especially if there's a genetic predisposition, it can bring on the disorder. So people, in terms of prevention, have to have that very much in mind.
Well, the same thing with cocaine. I mean, that's why, you know, siblings and, you know, even it should be being taught in our middle schools that if you have a predisposition to certain mental illnesses, you know, if you use cocaine, if you smoke marijuana, you have a chance of an induced psychosis. And it may not just go away. You know, this
I'm
is a
very impressed
thing.
That that's being taught. Is that in New York City that that's being taught?
No, I'm saying it should be being taught.
It should
taught.
Be. Oh, yeah.
It
absolutely
should be. Being
should
taught.
Be. It should be there. And there is actually curriculum that is available, but it just, I think it takes a while for things to come into school sometimes.
Well, that's why we always say, our motto, as I was telling you before, is you are your child's best advocate. If not you, then who? Become an informed, educated parent. It's the parent's job to educate the children. I always have told my children, you know, you may think going to a party and smoking a joint is no big deal, but if you're the one or your friend is the one that's going to wind up, you know, that it switches into a mental illness, and you know these drugs are laced. Easily. There are people that are now in psychotic states because of a benign smoking, you know, marijuana at a party. So it's not a simple thing. And that also blew my mind in your book, that this Dr. Z, who was your prescribing physician for Molly. How old was Molly when you went on that trip that really was the beginning of the end, when the doctor had not only told you that she should, but that she could, you know, encouraged her to be able to drink alcohol?
Yes.
How old
is she? Was just 16. And, you know, I have to give Dr. Zed, as we would say in Canada, a lot of credit because he really was the person that was able to extricate Molly from this really unhealthy relationship she had with Veronica, and which, you know, Veronica had sabotaged Molly's relationships with psychiatrists. And Dr. Zed really did work with Molly. He told us, working with her, once we were able to begin to disentangle her from Veronica, was like talking to somebody who had been brainwashed and programmed. She didn't have any actual incidents or resentments against us. She just had this little robotic insistence, you know, my family has done something to me. They're full of secrets and lies.
Well, do you think that initiated from Molly? Because that was something that I was curious about, because I know that, you know, these children sometimes go into therapy. Oh, by the way, I do see you callers, and I will get to your calls in a few minutes. You know, oftentimes children will go into their therapists and, you know, they'll exaggerate or they'll make things up. Do you think that these thoughts were put in Veronica's head from Molly, or do you think that this woman
in Molly's head? Absolutely. First of all, we know our own child's language, and Molly was never the kind of girl that watched Oprah or Dr. Phil would have even had these phrases about, this is a family full of secrets and lies. I mean, this is so bizarre coming out of her mouth.
I mean, this would,
and
have,
what
this doctor would have to be a very
is,
twisted woman.
Yeah, and what Dr. Zed said, because he, you know, he was her therapist for several years, she never had an example of some time when she felt mistreated by us. I mean, that those
right.
were not the issues.
You know, the other thing that struck me in the book was that I don't remember which evaluation this was, but at some point, I think you had came here to the States, and Molly had never had a PET scan or an MRI. And that
right.
was surprising to me. Is that something that, because my daughter became ill at the same time, even though they're much different in age, we were going through all of this at the same time. And I know here in the States, I mean, that was done fairly early, those tests. Was that something
well,
that wasn't commonly done in Canada?
Just in defense of Canada,
I'm not in Canada.
I understand that. No, I totally look. I'm an American and a Canadian, so I understand the whole big picture here about these issues. We certainly had easy access to medical care and psychiatric care, and very supportive psychiatrists. And when Molly didn't emerge from her psychotic episode, they were very supportive of our taking her to the Menninger Clinic. And you can do, and I think now that Menninger has moved from Topeka to Bailey, you can do the same thing of going for a week outpatient assessment. Absolutely. It's much more thorough than anything people would get in Canada, any place. But it costs $5,000 a week. I mean, it's phenomenally expensive, and I don't think that most Americans can really afford that either. And we thought
it's not affordable to have a mentally ill child in the United States.
No,
definitely
it is not. And around the issue of MRIs and PET scans, we actually thought that Menninger was going to give Molly an MRI because there is sometimes a tendency for somebody with schizophrenia to develop something called enlarged ventricles, which has to do with the mm-hmm. shrinking of some brain mass. And you want to be able to see if that has occurred. And Menninger hadn't let us know that they were in the process of moving from Topeka to Baylor. So they, in fact, didn't have their MRI equipment up. And we had to, back in Vancouver, continue to wait on a long list for an MRI. And, in fact, Molly did not have enlarged ventricles. But, you know, she was able certainly to get an electroencephalogram very early on mm-hmm. in the process, and that did alert
her. Well, that was just to, make sure she wasn't having seizures.
Well, no. There's more than that. I think that there's ways to look at the patterns that are being registered.
The waves, yes.
And sometimes those patterns aren't within the usual range for people who are dealing with a serious mental illness. And that was the case for Molly. So we didn't
have
that.
A caller who's been waiting quite a while. So I'm going to see if I can bring this caller on, and then we'll continue with the interview, because I do want to get to the point, which you really have to read the book, because there's, you know, so much history before we get to this. But I do want to get to the point where Molly begins to understand what is happening to her. But
right.
let's take this caller. Hi, welcome to the Coffee Clatch. Hello? Well, I'm sorry if I've missed your call. I know you were waiting a while. If you'd like to call back, we're going to be taking calls in about 15 minutes. So, Susan, as I was saying, there comes a point where Molly begins to understand her brainwashing, and she accepts that she's mentally ill. In a way, it must have been a tremendous relief to her. I mean, did she have the cognitive skills? I mean, you know, and before I do that, I did have one other question. You had said earlier that Molly was reading at age 4, or by fourth grade. But yet, when she was brought into, I forget which school that was. Let me see, I know I have it written here. She was being brought to the Fraser Academy in Vancouver, and you chose not to give them all that information. Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I'm sorry, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, how's it going? Thank you for taking my call. My name is Mark, and I suffer from schizophrenia.
Oh, okay. How are you? Susan, are you on the line?
I'm doing well, and I wanted to call and talk with the speaker, because part of my illness, I developed it when I was 23. It was inherited from my grandfather, who also had it, mother's side of the family. And I found that a lot of the things that I had to do in order to move forward was do my own research, and some of the best research I've read so far comes out of England from Kingston and Turgenton and their book Cognitive Therapy of Schizophrenia.
I've never heard of the book, but maybe you
have seen that book, and I'm very happy. Cognitive Behavioral Therapy actually has a really good track record with serious mental illness.
Yes, cognitive behavioral therapy is the, as far as I'm concerned, the only form of therapy that actually can treat schizophrenia in its entirety, the positive symptoms and the negative symptoms. And one of the big problem here in the States is that the cognitive behavioral therapists that are out there are expensive.
Yes.
They're like $225 an hour.
Oh, my goodness.
So, I do highly recommend reading the book Kingston and Turgenton's Cognitive Therapy of Schizophrenia, as well as Aaron Beck's Schizophrenia. At this point in my life, I'm 29. I don't deal much with the positive symptoms.
Right.
But what I find challenging and which medicine can't treat are the negative symptoms.
And which ones especially are you?
Well, for me, it's lack of motivation and lack of ability to not express emotions, but to feel pleasure in activity.
Right.
And the problem is that... And the problem is that medication, there's no medication for it yet.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the positive symptoms, there's medication, there's Seroquel, there's Abilify, there's different medications for it, but when you reach a point with cognitive behavioral therapy and with medication where you can manage your positive symptoms, it's just a whole new world of dealing with negative symptoms that is just completely challenging.
Yes, I think that you're right, that the medications are so not perfect yet. They have such a distance to go to really treat all of the symptoms that people with these brain disorders have to endure. And these are so difficult to live with.
Right, and I never had an MRI done. I live in California.
Right.
The way I was diagnosed is I had two episodes.
Right, and that's the usual way. I mean, MRIs are very unusual to use as a diagnostic tool.
Yes.
It's, you know, there's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual just has a list of common symptoms, and that's what's used to diagnose somebody with schizophrenia.
That is so true. And the last thing I want to say before I got the phone, I just wanted to give you that those two books, which I found were enormously helpful.
Great.
Is that you know, it's so discouraging that even within a psychological community in the United States, there is a stigma attached to schizophrenia.
Yes.
Most psychologists, when they leave their PhD program, are not capable of dealing with anything more than just minor depression and anxiety.
Yes, I think you're right.
And just to share a personal experience, I had the worst experience at UCLA.
Wow.
I had and that's supposed to be it's supposed to be world renowned and ranked and
yeah,
it was just it was just the worst experience ever.
Uh-huh.
And again, it went to show me that within a psychological community, even if you have the money and the means to get help, there are not many people out there willing to help you.
I think you're right, or who have the genuine expertise and knowledge and understanding and special skills that are actually useful. You're right. I agree with you.
And specializing psychiatrists, like you said, they're just so unaffordable. They don't take insurance. It's a very difficult situation.
Yes, yes. And right now, the point I'm in my life right now is I'm actually I'm trying to get into like an intensive treatment program in order to take care of my negative symptoms, in order to learn how to manage them.
Great.
Because it's such an entirely different world than the positive symptoms, where positive symptoms, you have a certain level of control with cognitive behavioral therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But with the negative symptoms, they just seem so rooted in so many unknowns that it's just so difficult to deal with. But I just want to share that. I wanted to recommend Kingston and Turgenton's research.
Yes.
They're brilliant.
One question I have for you is, this sounds very interesting that you have located a program that could help in working with these negative symptoms. And will your insurance company pay for this? your medicine?
Oh, that's what I'm working on right now. No.
Right.
Absolutely not.
It's a disgrace.
Yeah, when it comes to insurance, I'm on the pre-existing condition list.
Right.
So
what does that mean exactly?
That basically means I can't get insurance.
Oh.
That's what that means.
This changed in the U.S. recently, in that when I was at the NAMI conference in Washington, D.C. In July, we were hearing that, that the insurance companies are balking, but that they really are being required to begin to treat mental illnesses like other physical illnesses, which they really are, and
provide coverage. It's coming, but it's not here yet.
It's not there yet.
No, it's 2014. 2014 is the actual time when all of our health care is supposed to change.
Okay.
Up until that time, I'm still on the pre-existing condition list. Only fortunately for me, there is what's called insurance, high-risk insurance. It's expensive, but it's the only way that you can actually get insurance.
Okay.
It's
scary. One of the things I've noticed by going to the NAMI conferences is making contact with families for whom the medical bills, especially if there's hospitalization, can almost bankrupt them, and in some cases do bankrupt them. And that's really different about Canada. My daughter has had to have hospitalization at various times. We've never paid a penny for this.
No, I understand. You know what? I was treated in England.
Yes. Uh-huh.
By accident. I had an episode while I was living in England.
Yeah.
And I was actually treated there, and it was so amazing because I had one episode. That was my second episode. The first episode I had in California. And essentially what they did is they locked me in a hospital and gave me cigarettes every 2 hours, you know?
Oh.
I had no psychological treatment, no psychiatric treatment. It was basically, you know, stay here and be out of the way of people's lives. And, you know, whereas in England, when I was in England and I had an episode, we were able to walk, take tours. We were able to have group meetings, meet with psychiatrists, psychologists regularly.
Yeah.
And I felt so guilty that I was getting all of that for free.
Yeah.
You know, whereas...
But it's really the way it should be. And ultimately, what's interesting is that these illnesses cost society so much. I mean, there's tons of studies about what happens when you have untreated people with serious mental illness out on the street, and the ambulances coming back and forth, and the trips to emergency, and the prison system, which is so outrageous. Some people say in the U.S. now that there's many more people with serious mental illness in prisons than in hospitals. That's what's happened.
Absolutely.
And this shouldn't be the way that it is.
No, I don't believe so either. But, you know, a big problem, I think, is that I think it's the psychological community's fault because a lot of the psychologists are not advocates. This is going to sound pessimistic, and I don't want to sound pessimistic, but in my opinion, there are three kinds of psychologists. There's a psychologist who's in it for the money, who's not very good.
Mm-hmm.
There's a psychologist who's very good, but is in it for the reputation. They want to get a name. They want to get their name out in the psychological community. And they're not very good either because they're just doing it for the reputation. And then there's the actual few psychologists who really care.
Mm-hmm.
And they're tough to find. And I'm lucky I found one, but, you know, I had to knock on several doors, get doors slammed on me, you know, from people with expertise. And it's just the advocacy is not there.
Well, you know, you really have really hit on something because, you know, what you said, there's some truth to all of it. I mean, you know, there are the doctors that are looking for the notoriety and the grants, and they, you know, they're working with the pharmaceutical companies. And, you know, there are some that are just fantastic. I mean, I know the doctor that treats my daughter lobbies down in Washington monthly. Oh. I mean, he's really, you know, that's what he's doing. He's trying to make changes because the state of the mental health care in the United States is a national disgrace. It really is.
I have to say that there is one way that things seem better in the U.S. than in Canada. And there's an organization in the U.S. called the Treatment Advocacy Center. And people need to understand a key symptom that is in maybe 40% of people with a psychotic disorder, that in the midst of a psychosis, part of the illness is that someone doesn't understand they're ill, and they often refuse treatment. And so it's really important, and parents have to deal with this all the time, because we never want to do something our child doesn't want. But for their own good, we have to sometimes do everything possible to get them into a hospital and get them on the right medications and get them well. And often they will thank us afterwards, because that's a terrible state to be left to flounder in, with some misguided notion that that's respecting their human rights. What the U.S. has done, I guess in New York you have Kendra's Law, and I think from what I can understand, 44 U.S. states in recent years have realized that this is a problem with lack of insight. And so that if you make this a human rights issue of everybody should always have the choice, no matter how profoundly psychotic they are, to refuse treatment, then you get a lot of disasters. And so there are programs in the states, legal programs, that ensure that somebody who doesn't have insight and keeps going off their medication can be part of something called assertive outreach treatment, where if they do go off their medication and they clearly have a psychotic disorder and they keep relapsing and keep having to go back to hospital, that it can be that they basically are legally required to stay on their medication, or they will be taken back to hospital. So I think that these are, you know, they're painful to hear about anything that forces anybody to do anything. But with a disorder where somebody doesn't understand they're sick often, I think that it is the logical choice. And unfortunately, Canada actually has been moving in the other direction for these years, and I think a lot of families in Canada hope that we can halt this, because we're worried. I mean, a psychotic person can easily start to have some kind of very irrational interaction with the world and then with the police, and then all of a sudden families are dealing with the forensic system and the legal system.
Exactly.
And those bills are really amazing, and those experiences are hugely traumatic. To have a mentally ill person start to deal with a jail is just unbelievably cruel.
Yeah. You know, it is difficult, because once, you know, a child reaches a certain age, you know, the parents cannot, you know, bring them to a hospital and, you know, force them. You know, usually it has to be, you know, by an outside agency. So, you know, and it is important. A question that I do have for both of you, actually, is, are there any type of alternative treatments that are helpful for people with schizophrenia or psychotic mental illness? You know, I know for my daughter, who suffers from severe OCD and anxiety disorder, that acupuncture is doing more for her than any medication ever has.
That's great.
So I was just wondering if there are any type of alternative treatments
that interesting.
Help.
That's interesting, because recently, in the recent years, there's been a new form of therapy called ACT, Acceptance Commitment Therapy, which, from my limited understanding of it, embraces some Eastern methods, meaning it embraces, when it comes to schizophrenia, meditation.
They treat the body as a whole. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I think that there's no research for schizophrenia or bipolar disorder which doesn't take us back to the state of the art, which is medications are crucial. And then, absolutely, as you're saying, that doesn't solve everything. I mean, people's lives are blown apart by these illnesses, and they need and deserve all kinds of psychosocial rehabilitation programs and all kinds of therapeutic modalities.
I by no means meant in replace of medication.
Right.
You know, conjunctive type of
exactly.
A treatment. I mean, I would never consider taking my daughter off of her medications that are keeping her, you know, functioning. But, you know, like this gentleman was saying, that there are some symptoms that are not helped. And, you know, I was wondering if there were
like
I
take a strict regimen of medication, which is perfectly fine and perfectly well, and it's great, and it helps me a lot. But one thing they found that affects negative symptoms, which is what I experienced, is anxiety. So what my doctor has tried to recently incorporate into my regimen are things like yoga and meditation.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Not in replacement of the medication, but in a way so that I can learn to relax.
It sounds wonderful.
Because part of the negative symptoms is anxiety.
Yeah.
Yeah. So but again, I would never say in replacement of. I would say it's more.
Oh,
of
absolutely
a,
not. No.
Yeah.
No, absolutely not. But you know, different things help different people. I was just wondering, and you know, I think also that what I think both of you, you know, I'm sure you're aware of, but I think that the general population does not understand what schizophrenia is. I think that people think schizophrenia is multiple personality disorder.
Correct.
Right,
yeah.
And it's not.
Clearly, people do not understand what schizophrenia is.
Let me just do a very brief explanation.
Yes,
that
we
I
have
think
9 minutes
people.
Remaining.
Okay,
so
I'm going to do a very quick.
It's going to be on the air, but we can stay on much longer
okay,
than that.
Okay, a quick tour of what schizophrenia is. It's composed of three kinds of symptoms. Not everybody has all three types. One, as we just heard from Mark, was the term positive symptoms, and positive not meaning good, but something the illness adds on, often hallucinations, often auditory hallucinations, ideas of reference, so that people start to think that, you know, signs on billboards are speaking to them. So things that the illness brings that are delusional. Then negative symptoms, which Mark described very well, things that schizophrenia often takes away, the ability to experience pleasure, motivation, ability to connect well. I mean, Mark is so articulate, and that's fantastic, but sometimes people lose a lot of that ability. The third type of symptom relates to cognitive deficits, so that many people, doesn't seem like it's this way for Mark, who's just fabulous, but many people lose some cognitive abilities with the ability to sequence ideas, short-term memory, working memory, sometimes judgment, so that these are not givens and somebody always has to have them. We need faculties of education to get their special ed programs involved. I mean, I'm a teacher. We understand that kids have cognitive deficits, and there are programs developed to help them improve exactly those skills. But this is such an ignored population, and these needs, especially these cognitive needs, have been ignored. There are some good cognitive remediation, cognitive enhancement programs that are being developed in the States, and actually Vancouver has brought one up. But these are so necessary, and they're just not readily available.
Yeah, I think you put everything correct. And I think the important thing to understand is that not everyone experiences everything, and everyone with schizophrenia, the experience of schizophrenia is unique to almost everyone.
Right.
And in fact, I think the psychological manual, the DSM-4, it kind of clusters a bunch of symptoms and says, this is what it is, you know? Unlike other conditions which are more specific and classified.
Mm-hmm.
It basically indicates if you suffer from a certain amount of these symptoms, then you are suffering from schizophrenia for a prolonged period. And, my experience, from what I've read from Kingston and Turgenton, hallucinations, auditory and visual, feeling, usually are associated with, according to Kingston and Turgenton, some kind of trauma.
And I would object to that. I don't think that data is in.
Well, no, it is. With all humility, I'll defer to you, but Kingston tries to indicate that with the experience of hallucinations and those kind of things, they come from some form of trauma, because oftentimes the person who is experiencing the hallucination hallucinates about the traumatic experience. But my experience with schizophrenia has always been more of the delusional kind, which is ideas of reference, paranoia. So again, my experience is different. But again, I definitely defer to you. But I would definitely read Kingston and Turgenton, their theory. They're on the cutting edge of schizophrenia, and actually, England itself is on the cutting edge.
Cognitive behavioral therapy is much more readily available through the public health system in England than it is in Canada. I think Canada is realizing that there's the potential for a number of disorders. I mean, and certainly Marianne was mentioning obsessive-compulsive disorder, and cognitive behavioral therapy has a really good success rate.
Yes, it's worked wonders for me. It's worked wonders. The medication alone doesn't keep me functioning. It's cognitive behavioral therapy that's helped me continue to socially interact with others. Because when I first had my first major episode, I was so withdrawn that I would basically walk around with my head down.
Yeah.
You know, I had to relearn my skills through cognitive behavioral therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So,
therapy. Anyone with a mental illness, you know, the medications is half of the treatment.
Right.
I mean, there needs to be therapy involved. And you know, another thing I wanted to, to ask you was, you know, with other mental illnesses like bipolar or, you know, mild form, you know, like ADHD, there's a lot of comorbidity with OCD, with Tourette's, with anxiety disorders. Is schizophrenia the type of disorder where there are comorbid conditions? You know, as you were saying, you know, not everybody experiences the same.
Yeah.
Negative.
You know, one of them is the experience of something that's similar to autism. Mm.
Right.
Would you agree with that?
Well, it used to be called infantile schizophrenia, you know, back in the Stone Age. That's what they called it. Listen, my personal opinion, which is an unprofessional opinion, is that one day all of these mental illnesses are going to be like autism. It's going to be a spectrum. Because
yes.
It's just such, I call it people call it comorbidity, I call it potpourri. It is just such a blends of different disorders that I think that one of these days it's just all going to be looked at as a spectrum. But I was just curious as to if you can differentiate different comorbid disorders like OCD or panic or phobias or things like that, or is it a different entity in itself?
I think that they're very common when you talk with people with schizophrenia. They often have these difficulties that you're referring to as comorbidities. It's common. People can have depression, who are dealing with schizophrenia. There can be a lot of OCD issues and anxiety issues.
Which makes, you know, treatment, I would assume, very difficult because, you know, as you wrote in the book, you know, you were using olanzapine and you were using an anticonvulsant and not knowing that there was an interaction which caused, you know, a problem with absorption.
Exactly. The big issue that the book points out with my daughter was that for 2 years in her profound psychotic disorder, we thought, as she tried medication after medication, that she was getting a high dose of an antipsychotic. And because Tegretol, an anticonvulsant, had done such great work with her mood stability, you know, it was just sort of in place. And only later, when we took Tegretol away in order to introduce clozapine, which they can't coexist, and Molly woke up, basically, did she receive a really high dose of an antipsychotic, because then she received a full dose of 60 milligrams of olanzapine, and she snapped out of the psychosis.
It's amazing, you know, and like I said before, what works for one doesn't work for the other. But, you know, knowing the interactions is key. And also, you know, like I tell a lot of the bipolar parents and parents with children that are taking stimulants for ADHD, I mean, you have to be aware of the deficiencies in vitamins and minerals that these drugs cause to the body, which can also lead to problems. So,
yeah. You
know, it's a difficult journey.
Yes.
It really is. And Mark, I mean, I commend you. You know, you sound like you are really in control of your of taking care of your disorder. And, you know, I'm so glad you called in.
No, thank you for taking my call. And thank you, man. I really appreciate speaking with you. I very rarely get to speak with other people with schizophrenia. And I just wanted to call in just offer my support and just say that they're with cognitive behavioral therapy, the new medications, and even on the horizon, there are actually medications that are dealing with the negative symptoms. On the horizon, though, you know, there's hope, and it's no longer that illness that once you have it, you're just doomed to have it. It's actually, there's a lot of hope out there.
Absolutely, and you are so brave to share your story, and I just wish that parents who had a newly diagnosed son or daughter could hear you and feel so hopeful to see that somebody can recover this well. I mean, and I'm not minimizing the difficulties that you're describing that you still live with, but really, I think that you sharing your story can bring so much hope to people.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that, and thank you very much. I'm gonna share this this with my friends and family. This podcast.
Okay, it's archived. It'll be here.
Yeah, so I'm sure,
they
I'm, sure, I'm sure my sister and my family, my siblings would love to hear about how it's like to be a family member of someone who suffers with my illness.
Wonderful. So After Her Brain Broke, that's my book they need to find.
Oh, I will definitely buy it.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Okay, you have a good,
Thank
evening.
You, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
Take care of yourself. So, you know, Susan, I wanted to just get back. I know that you had started really advocating for the parents.
Yes.
You started different support groups. And why don't you tell us a little bit about how you turned lemons into lemonade?
Well, one of the things that I did was to really notice how many wonderful mothers I was meeting in different family education groups. I would go to conferences. I was also very public. I wrote an article for the Globe and Mail, which is Canada's big paper, right after we had a diagnosis of schizophrenia. I was not going to be in the closet. And because I was out, friends of friends and all kinds of people would refer somebody newly dealing with the situation to me. So I was meeting a lot of people. And at one point, I just decided to bring 10 women together in my home and have them listen to each other's stories. And I knew that everybody I was inviting knew the basics. They basically already were well-educated about these illnesses. That wasn't going to be the purpose of the group. The purpose of the group was going to be to share the ongoing issues and information that we were acquiring. And after bringing these women together for one night and seeing if they wanted to form a support group, they did. And eventually, several years later, I started another one. And these women have been so good to each other, and it is so important for people to find a group of people who really understand in a big way. I think a lot of us feel very guilty with our other friends when we're in the midst of crises, and the crises can go on for a long time because we are just bombarding
Absolutely.
Them with all of our struggles, and we don't like
to you
really...
You wrote about that in the book, that you felt that at some point you were a burden to your friends. And,
yes.
you know, that's something that I speak about often also here, is that, you know, we are each other's greatest support, the parents, you know, the mothers and the fathers that are going through this. We are the greatest support for each other.
Yes.
And there does come a point sometimes in your life, I mean, you know, the isolation of parents with mental illness, you know, I've written about that, it's just... It's just an incredible isolation that no
yes.
one else could ever understand. And
right.
part of it is because we have to cut people loose in our lives for reasons, you know, whatever reasons that, you
right.
know, they're having a negative impact on us.
Yes.
And, you know, there are other people that just can't deal with what we're dealing with. So isolation is caused by a lot of different factors. But, you know, as much as important as it is to find support, with other parents of special needs, it's also important not to isolate yourself, because just like you're doing and just like I'm doing, it's important to be out there.
Absolutely.
And to let, I mean, I really feel that the next generation, this is our job. Our job right now is to educate the parents so that they will educate their children, so the next generation will not live with the stigma of mental illness like our children and our families had in the past.
Right.
So, you know, I really commend you on what you're doing and, you know, coming out with your story. And, you know, I also wanted to talk about the siblings. I know you have an older daughter.
Yes. Yep.
And how has she dealt with Molly's illness?
Well,
what is the age difference? It's a significant age difference, isn't it?
It is. It is. It is 5 years.
Okay, it's not that big a difference.
Well, I described this in the book because, in fact, our family had a whole other catastrophe because my husband developed cancer during this time, which, you know, all of these families that are dealing with children with mental illness often still go through the difficulties that strike everybody.
Absolutely.
So we sort of had
yep.
a double whammy. And my older daughter was crucial because I was really overwhelmed. Molly was not doing well. And my older daughter just, I felt like at some point when I watched how she responded to my husband's diagnosis of stage 4 renal cell carcinoma, was doing everything she'd seen me do in trying to be a case manager for Molly, and the lists and the appointments. And so basically she took over getting all of these initial things set up. And in fact, as the book says, things turned out unbelievably well, and my husband is alive and thriving.
Yes.
So my older daughter has played a very important role in our lives.
You know, we talk a lot about, you know, how difficult it is for the siblings and giving the siblings quality time. And, you know, I know myself, you know, I think sometimes I overcompensate because of, you know, you feel badly for what they've, you know, had to go through, you know, having a sibling that has a mental illness. But, you know, in the end, I mean, I really think these kids become much better people.
Yes.
They learn compassion and they learn priorities. And, you know, I think that these kids, once they get older, really are quite a contribution. So,
I agree. We were very fortunate because our older daughter was away at university. But I've gotten to know so many other parents, and especially when there's younger siblings from younger than the person with the mental illness, how stressful it is for those parents to juggle
yes.
all of this. Families
yes, I know, you
deserve
know.
A lot of support.
And, you know, it's not available. I mean, unless you have a child with a really significant disability, and usually those disabilities are physical, here in the United States, there is no respite. I don't know about in Canada, but there really is no respite to help unless, you know, there's hospitalizations. Excuse me.
No,
which
this is a terrible
is
problem.
Answer.
Because, and certainly in a system like Canada where we do have socialized medicine, so our ill family members would be taken care of by the healthcare system if we weren't doing it. We save the healthcare system millions of dollars by our unpaid labor and our efforts. So really, families need to become much more active in advocating for genuine respite services.
Yes,
we
know it's important because the family unit, it's to have a child, you know, that has this type of an illness is devastating enough.
Right.
To have the family unit broken apart by it and to have the, you know, the emotional strain and the one primary caregiver, you know, it's just not a good way to go with this. So respite care is very important. You know, we talk about date night, and that was something I saw that I liked when I read about your book, that, you know, you did take the time, you know, you with your husband, that you did go out and, you know, go out with other couples and go out to dinner. And it's really, it's so important.
It is important. Absolutely, it's important.
So I know that, you know, you've done a lot of work with NAMI, and I know that you've done a lot of work with the parents. And, you know, is there anything else that you'd like to talk to us about before we, you know, end the show? And I just wanted to also say that, you know, I'm sorry to hear that, you know, Molly's had a setback, but I'm also glad to hear that she's improving, and our thoughts are with her.
Thank you. I think the main thing is just to keep encouraging parents, even when things are going bad, that your efforts can make a difference. And it may not look that way for a long time, but really sticking to the course of looking for the best treatment makes a difference.
Yes, and, you know, you make that very clear in the book. And, you know, anyone who's listening who has a child with schizophrenia or a family member, after her brain broke, is just an extraordinary story. And it just shows how, you know, you can endure something like this and, you know, make good of it and to help other people. And, you know, like you, that's what we're about, just helping other people that are going through this. So I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Marianne.
And when you come out with your next book, make sure you give us a call.
Wonderful.
Take care, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
As we end the show every day, you are your child's best advocate. If not you, then who? Become an informed, educated parent. Join me tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock on our tweet chat, where I will be moderating, and the topic will be the organic basis of anxiety and depressive disorders in children and adolescents. I'll be going through different causes, which could be an endocrine disease or an immunological problem. So join me tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock. Until then, have a good night.